our computers and our desks aren't worth much. It's the people that allow us to offer something to our clients.
You're listening to the Building Better Futures podcast, where innovation meets inspiration. In each episode, host Eric Hirani journeys alongside notable thought leaders who are shaping the future, cultivating exceptional work cultures, and nurturing the next generation of trailblazers. We aim to spark inspiration by engaging in dialogue with leaders from groundbreaking companies, innovative projects, and exceptional teams. Our goal is to empower individuals to positively impact those around them and leave a lasting legacy of positive change in our communities and society at large. Let's dive in together and explore what it takes to build better futures, one conversation at a time.
Today, I'm joined by Julia Murphy, architect, partner at SOM, and importantly, an advocate for women in design and construction. Hey, Julia, how are you?
I am well.
I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. And before we kick off the conversation, I always start with good news and gratitude. And so I'll ask you, is there like professional or personal good news or gratitude you can share with me in the audience?
Well, it's a beautiful day in New York City. You can't see the window behind me, but the sun is shining on the skyline. We just had Easter and Passover and a ceasefire. And there's just so much to be grateful for in this amazing city. We made it through a cold winter and, you know, hopefully bright skies ahead.
It's funny. I just came out of a coffee meeting right before we jumped on here, and I met with a good friend of mine, and I shared two of those sentiments with him directly. One, just around like the practice of gratitude, right? And just appreciating what life has to offer. And he and I like really connect on that. So we always have that as part of our conversation. And the other one was just like, what a difference it makes when the sun is out. And
yeah.
I was talking to my family about the same thing. It just makes you feel, I felt like, I feel alive when the sun is out, even if it's cold,
yeah.
Right? It's a little bit chilly today.
Right.
And by the time this airs, it won't be. But, you know, just for those listening, it's 46 today, but it's sunny and it feels amazing because
yeah.
We just came out of one of the worst winters I can ever remember in living in this area.
Agreed. Yeah.
And
we deserve a little bit of brightness. And
we really do. And then the second part of the conversation that you touched on, and so I will make this, I always like to share a gratitude too. We were talking about as we get older, will we retire somewhere else? And I was like, I would love to get away from the winters here, but I just love New York City and there really isn't anything like it. And when you think about it, people come from all over the world to come to New York City and like, and I totally get why. Even though I live here, I still understand why, because I really love New York City and there's just
yeah.
so much it has to offer. So
right. Little moments of
yep.
looking back on a bridge on the skyline and pinching myself that I'm here and I get to do this.
So it's an amazing feeling. And especially for our industry, right? I mean, the city, the physical infrastructure is like so core to who we are and what we do. I just love it. All right. Well, great. So you just mentioned, you know, how you pinch yourself about where you are and tell us that story. How did you get to where you are? You know, where did you grow up? Where did you go to school? How did you end up as a partner at SOM? Give us your background.
Sure. I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm a third generation architect.
Wow.
I never knew my grandfather. He was born in the 1880s. And was very old when my father was born, but I definitely grew up with his legacy. He was a young Irish guy born in Chicago, and he made his way to Washington, D.C., worked for the architect of the Capitol, and got a steamership to Paris and took the exam to get into the École des Beaux-Arts, which was sort of the architecture school of the time, and came back to the U.S. And in the world of Irish Catholics, he founded the architecture school at Catholic University. Many of the graduates of that era, it was sort of a time when many American architecture schools were either being founded or remodeled on the model of the Beaux-Arts system. So I grew up with that, and my father had a practice in Baltimore, and I grew up resisting, I think, the urge, you know, spent a lot of time kind of complaining about pictures, going on vacation and only having pictures of buildings to show, or my dad leaving us in the car in different neighborhoods in Baltimore and going off to take pictures of projects. But the whole time it was rubbing off. I was an English major in undergrad. And by the time I was ready to graduate, I had had the very awkward conversation that, Dad, I think I'm interested in architecture. And from there, I came to New York. I worked in the marketing department of Cohn Pedersen Fox, which was amazing. I was working with some of the very senior most partners at, you know, what was a very, and still is a very storied architecture firm, and really got a view towards the hustle and the excitement of winning work, right? And from there, I went to Penn to go to architecture school. And I always say I loved Philadelphia. I don't necessarily remember leaving, but I got a job over the summer in Ireland, and I came back and moved to Brooklyn and really never looked back. I've been in love with New York since I was in high school, and, you know, coming to the city to go to museums or, you know, just walk around on the streets was so energizing and inspiring. So yeah, I have never looked back. I've been in Brooklyn, I guess, for, you know, almost 25 years. And I can't believe I'm so lucky that this is what I get to do.
I love the energy you have. I mean, more like your answer was awesome. And I have a couple of things I want to talk about, but sure. Your energy is just like, it's contagious. I'm like, I'm amped up just having this conversation. So first question, Ireland, where were you and what were you doing there? And I've been to Ireland probably like three, maybe four times. I actually really enjoy it. I love it there. But tell us a little bit about your time there.
Yeah, I had a professor refer me to a former classmate who had been invited to the European Central Bank competition, which was a big, substantial, and prestigious competition in Europe at that moment. It was during the Irish Tiger economy. European architects from all over Europe were in Ireland at the time. So it was very exciting. I was incredibly, you know, newly graduated. And, you know, there's so much to learn when you start working professionally. But it was amazing. And I had never been to Ireland before. I have many of my progenitors came from Ireland, but it was an amazing experience as an American, which I think is incredibly common, right? The American coming back, but, you know, thinking, hey, the economy in Ireland was actually much better. This was 2003, was much better than in New York. It was kind of a post 9/11 recession when I graduated, and I was going to work in Ireland because that's where there was a job opportunity. So, you know, that was felt very amazing to me. And what an amazing city Dublin is.
Very cool. And I think it probably is a testament to you and your work ethic that your professor kind of recommended you for that. You know, I'm sure it was highly sought after based on the competition, and it sounds really exciting. I have like an aside, and it's kind of just a funny story and I like to share. So I went to college with my roommate who had been like my best friend from like seventh grade. And he's got a Gaelic name. His name is Pádraic, but it's spelled, you know, that's how you say it phonetically, but it's spelled P-A-D-R-A-I-C. Mm-hmm. And so freshman year, everyone's name is like on your door, right? And the RA comes around and my name is Eric, right? Which, you know, I probably don't look like your typical Eric, and he probably looks more like an Eric than I do. But yeah. So the RA comes around and he looks at my friend Pádraic and he's like, yeah. So you must be Eric. And then he looks at me, he's like, I don't know how to say your name because obviously it's spelled in a very interesting way. And I was like, hey man, I'm Eric and you can deal with him on how to say his name. And I always, right. I just find that to be so funny.
Turning the expectation.
Yeah, yeah.
In your head.
He's still like one of my best friends to this day. So it's a good story.
Yeah.
I appreciate you sharing what brought you to Ireland. The other thing that I think was so amazing is, so you're third generation. And so I'm also multiple generations into this industry. And I think it's really powerful how our like parents and their experience really shapes, I think, what we bring to the industry. And I went to a speaking seminar a couple of weeks ago, and I actually told this. The story I told was around how I felt so fortunate, and I didn't realize it at the time, to be raised, you know, like with both an entrepreneur. So my dad's also an entrepreneur and an engineer. And so it sounds like you probably had similar experiences, right? As much as you thought at the time, I don't know why he does this. I don't understand this. I definitely don't want to do it. In the back of your mind, a little bit was like, this is really cool. And yeah. I really do like what he's doing.
Right, right.
So I thought that was interesting.
I mean, I think it's also given me perspective. You asked me, you know, why or if I consider myself an advocate for women. And I certainly do. I know that I come from a position of privilege. My parents went to college. I had the profession, you know, my dad started his own firm in our living room at some point. And, you know, that kind of demonstration is certainly, it's an advantage, right? But the industry can still feel hard and exclusive, even to somebody with those kinds of privileges. So it's a reminder to me how much we owe the next generations to make sure we're bringing in people who may have had that kind of opportunity, but certainly those who did not have the same kind of professional demonstration close to home in their family at all, and making sure we are making space for voices with different experiences.
You like, and I might have to take that soundbite, but you kind of hit the crux of why, like, I wanted to do a show like this was exactly that. I felt fortunate that I always had a good mentor in my dad, but even all of the people he surrounded himself with, because they were typically of industry and were great advisors. And you know, as I got further into my career, I realized not everyone has that. And, you know, I have so many stories from like people that have heard someone on the show, you know, someone, and I'm sure you're going to inspire someone, and they will just like write like short emails, nothing crazy. And not that I did anything, it was really the guest, but just like, you know, I heard so-and-so tell that story and it resonated with me because I didn't think someone like me could rise to that position, but you know, they clearly did. So I think I can. And it changes, right? Like, and I never had that limitation. So again, it was just a place of privilege for me to just like, my dad was an entrepreneur and he was an engineer. And like, of course I could do that if I wanted to, right? Like, but not everyone is able to see that. And so I want to talk a little bit, let's talk about, you know, advocate for women in design and construction, because it's interesting. I normally don't add that as part of an introduction, and you like, you specifically wanted it. I think it's wonderful that you did. And tell us a little bit about the challenges that like do still exist for women in the industry, you know, and what advice do you have for the up and coming, you know, maybe emerging professionals, early career professionals, or even students that might listen to the show that are women and want to one day be a partner at an amazing firm like SOM?
Well, thank you. I remind myself of that because I owe it to the pioneering women who came before me, who broke through barriers and ceilings. And I owe it to the people who will be here after me that I made an even, hopefully, a better place for for them, especially as we go through cycles of headwinds and, you know, reconciling and correcting or not correcting. You know, I just think that I don't take it for granted that we are always moving into a more humane sort of configuration of ourselves. I think, you know, like in all art forms and professions, that having different voices represented and confidently being heard, it improves. It improves the output, the outcomes. So I try to remind myself to uphold those principles. I've had a really unique experience recently. I was able to attend a really special all-girls private school in Baltimore. And I got financial aid. I really pinched myself to be there, and it opened up huge worlds to me. And a couple of colleagues and I had the opportunity to interview to do a new building on the campus. And it's, you know, you don't always get that kind of 360 opportunity, but the school was founded in the 1880s by a group of feminist women who wanted to ensure that there was a pipeline. It's called the Bryn Mawr School. It was set up to be a feeder for Bryn Mawr College, which was one of the few colleges at the time where women could have opportunities. And that's where I became a feminist in sort of, you know, hopefully the most inclusive sense. So to be able to go back with a unique all-women team, I love men, I love working with men. It was sort of happenstance that we had this just great team who had the most experience in the typology. And we're starting construction in June. We're so excited. And it's been such a unique moment to kind of come back to a place that formed me and hopefully help form it for the next couple turns of the wheel.
That's very cool. And I want to pull something out that you said, which was around the fact that the team just happened to be all women, but they were because of their experience, right? And that can always, that I think sometimes the two things get conflated where it's like, oh, you can either be qualified or you could, you know, be, I don't know what the right word is, but like minority represented, yeah, group, right? Like, and it's not true. Both things can be true. You know, you can be, yeah, both qualified and a woman, or qualified and, you know, have another differentiating factor. So I think that's amazing. It sounds like the team is awesome, and congrats on going into construction soon and to be able to give back, right, to a place that obviously gave a lot to you. So I'm sure that that's like a very, very fulfilling part of it. And, you know, it kind of leads me into, so let's, now that we're kind of talking about projects, right, tell us like about like what's the biggest challenge you've had, and it doesn't necessarily have to be on the project you just talked about, but in your career, right, you've worked on some incredible projects, and if you want to talk about any of them, feel free, but tell us about like the most challenging moment you faced on one of those like mega projects or massive projects you've worked on.
Yeah, I guess one project I go to was a renovation of a bank headquarters in Lower Manhattan. And when we won it, it was back in 2013. It was two buildings from the 80s, and they were built when Tribeca was sort of, and I don't want to denigrate any neighborhoods, but, you know, it was a low rent district. It was a great place to put printing facilities or back of house bank facilities. And the bank had decided to make this their central headquarters. It was right after the great financial downturn. It was a show of fiscal constraint. And it was a fantastic pursuit. We had a great team. We had a lot of, you know, it's really great to come together with a group and have a great idea and pitch it and win the job, right? That feels tremendous. And then I had a moment where I realized, oh my gosh, we are going to renovate almost 2 million square feet of office, you know, 1980s office tower. And to be honest, it wasn't my dream of becoming an architect, right? But that project turned out to be very transformational for me in terms of my ownership of my pieces of scope and, you know, and the way I was able to work with, you know, really great teams from some of the best construction companies in the city, some of the best owners reps. So, you know, as people move through the industry, they, you know, sometimes you move from the consultant side into the owner side. And, you know, if you add up the years of experience, right, especially as a younger person, it can be intimidating, right? You know, you have not only, you know, have you seen this kind of project, you've built it, you know, maybe yep. somebody across the table. But it was really transformational for me in terms of the team and the way I was able to kind of move professionally into a next gear and really be taken seriously, but take myself the right level of serious, right? We need to be on teams and get along. And the people and the teamwork of that project, while it, you know, it wasn't on the cover of a design magazine, I think we materially changed the experience of 12,000 people who go to work every day, changed their health, changed their experience, and made an impact in a way that I did set out to do when I decided to become an architect.
This episode is brought to you by Infinite Consulting Corp, your go-to firm for MBE certified project and construction management consulting. Discover how Infinite can help you build a better future at infiniteconsultingcorp.com.
So I'm going to let's talk a little bit about that impact, because another question, and I actually always love to hear these stories, is a lot of what we do does impact an end user, right? In like a very profound way. Either they're going to live there, or they're going to work there, or they're going to learn there, or they're going to, you know, whatever part of their life is going to engage with that infrastructure, it's going to be significant to them. Tell us about like a time maybe an end user gave you like you have a personal story about how they were like, this really changed like my life, right? The way I'm either, you know, my work is different, right? You just said you changed 12,000 people's life about how, mm-hmm. you know, because they were going to report to that office. Is there like a story you can think of, or a time that really happened in a personal and meaningful way?
Certainly that has happened. I think both at the highest level and then at the really personal level, you know, we've had CEOs, we worked on a new headquarters for Disney also in Hudson Square in Lower Manhattan, and have heard substantive feedback about sort of changing the way an organization that had previously been an accumulation of different cultures and businesses assembled together in a purpose-built environment when they had been sort of spread across the city. And that, you know, the experience of coming together in a space that is hopefully inspiring has been transformative to their business, you know, and that is incredibly reinforcing. But I'll go back to that bank project that, you know, even knowing the person who sits or stands sometimes, you know, at a desk in a lobby, right, and is suddenly connected to nature, right, is seeing the light cycle of the day and understanding how that is transformational is, you know, that's meaningful.
So you mentioned a really cool project in there, which was the Disney headquarters. I know you've also worked on Manhattan West, right? Which was like an incredibly iconic development. We did some work there too, and I love the way it came out. And as a Long Islander, I'm going into Penn a lot. And now I very often will exit through like that Ninth Avenue exit, like the new one that's all the way at the end. It's like, it's beautiful over there. But walk us through like the early days of that project, right? I mean, I can't imagine there must have been so many obstacles you guys had to overcome. And, you know, growing up in the city and spending a lot of time here as you have, that part of the city looked totally different 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
So talk to us a little bit about Manhattan West as an iconic program that you worked on.
Yeah. It's, again, working in teams in collaboration with really inspiring clients. You know, I think working with really professional and sophisticated clients is, you know, it can be hard at times because they're very smart and sophisticated, yeah. Right? And sometimes, you know, it's harder to do your own professional role when your client is a professional as well and has a lot of that similar experience. But working for really good developers is amazing. I joined the Manhattan West team as a very, you know, in my mind, junior level person. And we started going to meetings in the basement of the AP building, what is now 5 Manhattan West. And we had like a little clear story window out onto the tracks and the open rail yard below, and started working. It was, again, the project had been in the SOM office before 2008. There had been some sort of very schematic level development. But during that period of time after 2008, Brookfield, our client, made the really interesting and smart decision to use the time to get ready for the next sort of cycle. And started building this very, very innovative bridge structure, which was going to happen fast. And Eric, as you know, building over an active Northeast Coast corridor, rail connection and rail yard is time is money. Time is money. So our team had to work really quickly to understand what the future limitations of this very innovative post-tension precast structure would be, because it was going to really pave the way. It was going to save so much time, get protection over that track level, and enable a lot of construction. But it really changed the baseline structural approach to the project and this enormous entire, you know, multiple 2 Manhattan City blocks sort of structure. And that was an amazing time of thinking about, okay, well, you know, if the span is here, you know, we might need a future column here, but we can't have one here. And sort of thinking in that flexibility space, right? That was an amazing education in, we want to buy as much flexibility as possible. How much does that cost, right? But we can only spend this much. So we can only buy this much flexibility. So how many futures can we allow for within that budget? So anyway, it's some sort of amazing spatial and monetary puzzles that have to happen, you know, really quickly to get the best future scenarios across the board, not knowing what the future is going to hold.
Two things I want to draw out of that. One is like that puzzle, but like that's the fun of it, right? I mean, it's so hard, right? Because you're right. Hey, clients are demanding, right? You mentioned, you know, in a good way, right? They have every right to be demanding. They should be. Yeah, they're smart. And then so you have finite budget, you have finite time, you probably have infinite ideas, right? And it's like, how am I going to make this work to keep everyone happy, keep this on schedule, keep this within budget, and produce something that I am proud of at the end of the day, right? Because you kind of put your name on things that you work on. And, you know, at least most leaders I know and work with, like, feel that way, right? Like that personal sense of ownership of the projects they work on. And then the other part of your answer that I want to touch on, and I actually want to talk to you a little more about this, was I've heard the stories, right, of that, like when they were building the post-tension foundation above the tracks and how like crazy that was. And what do you see like in the future? Like what, like that was, that's super innovative, right? What's next in terms of like innovation and technology on these larger projects being developed?
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the best things about this work is people and, you know, working with some really great colleagues who have built enormous, enormous and complex projects. And we were talking about, I was talking to a project executive, very experienced, who was talking about, you know, what's next for him. We had a really big, long run in New York, sort of before the pandemic, and things are coming back to New York. But there were some really significant projects that were built and expertise that was built. And, you know, some people are focused now in the Middle East or India. I love the stories of how when Canary Wharf happened in London, in the 90s, you know, a huge proportion of the New York group kind of went over there to bring that expertise. And what I'm getting to is AI, right? I think AI will have, you know, radical impacts on what we do in terms of iterating designs and solutions and scenarios. I think, you know, in the physical world, certainly increased sensors, you know, the ability to automate, but there is still the material resistance in the real, in the physical world, you know, that won't certainly, we can make some major inroads on the construction site for sure, right? With accuracy and sort of advanced sensors. But yeah, physics will remain. I'm sure as an engineer, that's something that you think about.
I think AI is, you know, and it's hard to quantify because it will be like almost as revolutionary as the internet was, but I think even more so than that. And the analogy I like, and I don't know if it's fair or not, is almost the invention of the telephone, which is, there was a point in time before the telephone existed that if you told someone like, well, you could pick up and talk to someone across the world, they would say to you, no, I can't. This is how far my voice travels. This is how far someone can hear me. And your mind just could not accept that new like paradigm, right? That I could pick up the phone and call someone else. And I think AI is going to be that. Like, I think there's a fear that it's going to take all of our jobs, which I don't think it will. I do think it's going to make us hyper efficient and effective. And if you don't learn to embrace it and use it, that you will get left behind. You know, I was at an AI seminar a couple of weeks ago, and out of all people, it was Jordan Belfort said this. So if you've seen The Wolf of Wall Street, you know, he's back, he's out of jail. And I think he's doing he's like speaking and stuff like that. But one of the quotes that they shared with us that day was, he said something recently, I think he was speaking in the Middle East somewhere. And he said, you know, I think he's also a VC. I'm sure he's got an interesting background. But the quote is, in 10 years, there will be two types of companies, those that embrace AI at this moment and those that don't exist. And I really feel that it's moved very quickly, and we've got to embrace and adopt it in a responsible way, right? In an ethical way. You know, it kind of comes back to that puzzle, right? Like, it's not necessarily just time, money, and schedule, but it is still like ethically responsible, appropriate training of the staff members, but harnessing the technology at the same time, right? And trying to figure all that out at once is fun. You know, you talked about some of these mega projects. One of the other things I'm hoping to be able to advocate for in this show is more building and more construction. And you mentioned how everything comes in cycles, and it does. And so like whenever there's a lull, I always try to, you know, we calm the team down and we say, listen, this has happened before. It'll come back. Mm-hmm. And very similar to your sentiment, I'm feeling it's coming back. We're getting a lot more high-rise work, right? We do a lot of infrastructure work, so that has been steady and that's been great. But we're getting more requests on the building side, which is exciting. And so my question to you related to that is like city leaders, right, are obviously very bright, but the urban environment may not be their expertise, right? And so what would you share with them about how to prioritize building a better urban environment? What should they be prioritizing or thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's interesting. I think we're at a place where our leaders are thinking about cities and, you know, the housing crisis.
Yep.
Sort of post-COVID downtown, the built environment is political right now. And it is also just pragmatic. And, you know, even in New York, right, we've passed some really significant zoning changes for housing and to enable more development, like the Winds. We have a project that is going through a landmarks approval in the Soho NoHo district that was rezoned. And so the first projects are going through and sort of testing that. And even the tone of the discourse, right, of how we think about making room for more housing in our communities has changed significantly. So I believe that our electeds, even the city council, you know, not just city planning in New York, right, to be really myopic and hometown focused. You know, city planning and the mayor's office and city council all are clamoring for a piece of for expertise to help inform policy. And I think are coming with a sophisticated, educated sort of ideas about what did we learn from COVID about what makes our cities and neighborhoods vibrant, and how important addressing the housing crisis is to our, you know, the political base, to the economic viability of the city. So I think it's such an interesting time, and the young architects want to be part of the solution, and that's really inspiring.
Very cool. Yeah. And I agree with you. I think your city leaders have been prioritizing the building and the growth of the city. And, you know, the city of yes regulation has been really interesting. I saw there were some rezonings that just like, I think, finally got through, which is really exciting. Even on the public housing side, right, with the Preservation Trust, I think they're looking at innovative ways to get funding and get some projects done. And, you know, Vlada Knip's doing, I think, a great job over there. So it's like very exciting. So I appreciate you sharing your thoughts on that. Before we jump into our final segment, which is going to be finish the sentence, I am a big like quotes and mantra type of person. So I'm just curious if there's like one that you subscribe to that, you know, like kind of just is your fallback when, you know, you're just like challenged by something.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have in the last 2 years, I have been diagnosed with a motor neuron disease. And it has changed the way I walk and get around the city. And, you know, it's opened me up to the idea that, and especially, you know, we're a society divided, right? We're at a place where we are not always civil to each other. And to move around as a disabled person, which is sort of a new identity for me, it can feel threatening, right? Like when you're when your physical body is vulnerable, it can feel like a threat. And I remind myself regularly how kind people are. And people remind me of it too, that generally everybody is kind, you know, and people want to help. So honestly, that is a mantra that has been helpful to me. Like, you know, you're not under attack. People are kind. And it's proven to be true.
I love it. People are kind is such a great, like, and what a positive spin. And I didn't know about your diagnosis. And I hope it sounds like you're handling it in great spirits, but I hope it's okay.
Thank
right?
you. Yeah. Life has all kinds of new perspectives to reveal to us.
For sure. Well, we will jump into our last segment. So it's finish the sentence. And, you know, the way we'll do this is I'll start a thought and I'll leave a blank in the sentence. And I want you to finish it with whatever word comes to mind. And don't overthink. Just go with your instinct here.
Right.
This is a surprise round. Yes, this is. So the first sentence is high performance without blank is dangerous.
Oh, without heart.
Very cool. I love it. And yeah, right. If you don't care about what you're doing and you're just working really hard towards something, it's like gonna, that's like kind of where burnout, I think, comes in, right? If you're not passionate about it, because high performance is fun if you believe in it or you love it, right? Next one I'm going to ask you is leadership is really about blank.
People, right? And understanding motivation.
It's another great answer. And it's so interesting. I was talking to a future guest earlier today about the show, and we were going through our values. And, you know, I was articulating for us, people is a value, because I was trying to incorporate how we care about the community, how we care about our projects, but we also care about our employees. And we realized it really comes down to the people, you know? And so that's, I love that. Love that.
Yeah. Answer. Our computers and our desks aren't worth much. It's the people that allow us to offer something to our clients.
For sure. And so that was it. Quick, painless, right? That was easy enough.
Yeah, thank you.
And with that, I will give you an opportunity. Any final thoughts or anything you want to share with the audience before I sign off?
Thank you, Eric. Thank you for inspiring and asking questions and bringing a little bit of heart to what we do here, you know, which can be very nuts and bolts, literally.
Well, I love it. And I honestly, I always thank the guest. I know your schedules must be incredibly packed. Everyone is so gracious with their time. And it's something I really learned about the industry over time, which my dad tried to teach me, was like, if you have a question, just pick up the phone and ask that person. And I think it really speaks to what you said earlier, that people are kinder than you think, and they will pick up the call and they will just help you and they will answer your question. And to this day, I struggle with that at times, but I'm trying to be more conscious of that fact. And I'm also trying to be the person that if someone calls me, I pick up the phone and I answer that question and I help them, right? Like a pay it forward kind of thing. So with that, that's all the time we have for today. This was an incredible conversation. Thank you so much, Julia.
Thank you.
Thanks again to our audience for listening, and keep an eye out for our next episode.
This episode is brought to you by Infinite Consulting Corp, your go-to firm for MBE certified project and construction management consulting. Discover how Infinite can help you build a better future at infiniteconsultingcorp.com.